Let me show you how to be a good Bayesian. Change your predictions after taking information in.
Christopher, to come back to you, you also mentioned that you guys do population inferences, and that's hierarchical models where you use a bunch of observations to infer the underlying distribution of the sources of the signal, if I understood correctly. So what does that look like? What do you guys do here?
Yeah, so we do the calculation in a couple of stages. That we always run the parameter estimation to get the events parameters for just one signal at a time first. And so the result of that is a set of posterior samples calculated with a fiducial prior. And what we want to do is then divide out that prior, put in a population model, see how well that fits, so calculate the evidence under the assumption of a particular set of hyperparameters, and then we have a inference one level up where we vary the population parameters, the hyperparameters for the population model, explore that to see what fits works. So that really is starting to get the astrophysics, so looking at the distribution of masses, are there more low mass black holes than high mass black holes? How does that scale? Is there little bumps in the distribution and things like that? It's a next level up. The likelihood isn't quite as expensive as evaluating the waveforms, but we have some data handling issues of reading in all the posterior samples. And key to this is, as I alluded to, is correcting for the selection effects, so that we need to account for the fact that with our gravitational wave detectors, we can preferentially see some sources over other sources. So if you were just to look at the distribution of sources that we detect, you'll see, hey, there are lots of 30 solar mass black holes. There aren't too many 10 solar mass black holes. And if you didn't know about our selection effects, you'd naturally assume, okay, the universe is full of 30 solar mass black holes and 10 solar mass ones are much rarer. Whereas because our detectors are more sensitive to the high mass signals, those are intrinsically louder, so we can see them further away, we can see more of them. Once you correct for the selection effects, you actually see it's the other way around. There are many more, at least there should be many more 10 solar mass black holes than 30 solar mass black holes. And the fact we don't see so many 50 solar mass black holes, 90 solar mass black holes, tells you that the distribution does drop off quite rapidly. So this is a field that's growing quite nicely as we get more and more detections. Your uncertainties on the population basically go as the square root of the number of detections. What we're seeing a lot of work on is what does one assume for the population model? So when we started off, following what is common in astronomy, we put a power law through for the masses, just infer the power law index, basically in the normalization for the overall rate, and see how that worked. Then we're like, that's a bit simplistic. Let's add in a couple more parameters. Let's have, say, a little peak, a Gaussian add on top of that to get peak. Let's say have two power laws with the break, see how those fit. Let's put in another peak. And now people are looking at semi-parametric models. So, okay, what if we add a spline on top of that, see how we can vary that? Or what if we do something really flexible, so allow a bunch of kernels to come together and infer the population to get out of there. So a lot of the work at the moment is trying to see what is a good fit for the data, and then checking, is this overly complex? Are we overfitting? Is there a little bump there? Is that just because of a Poisson fluctuation that we've only seen so many events? So small number statistics means there's a few more here and a few fewer there. Or is there actually some feature of the underlying population, which may be a hint to how stars evolve. So I think it's quite an interesting time at the moment from this testing out models, trying to determine do they fit the observations quite well. And I'm very excited for getting the results of our upcoming observing runs when we have a much larger number of detections and we'll really be able to constrain the models to higher accuracy and precision.
Yeah, so that's super interesting. And so here, to understand what you're doing, It's like you're hearing different sounds and you're trying to infer not really what the sound is about, but what is emitting that sound? What is the source of that sound? And the issue is that these sounds can be emitted by a lot of entities, and a lot of these sources you don't really care about because, I don't know, they are on Earth. They are like, but what you're interested in are the sources outside which are in space and which tell you something about the universe, which here would be mainly neutron stars and black holes colliding. How weird was that characterization?
Yes, that's good. I guess maybe a nice analogy might be, imagine you have a room full of people and you're trying to judge the composition of the room. And, you know, some of the people there, you have a bunch of librarians who are very quiet, and you have some heavy metal stars who are very, very loud. And so you've made your recording of the audio in the room, and then you need to try and reconstruct that. Okay, I can only hear one librarian, but given that the librarians are very quiet, there's probably a whole host of other librarians who I just missed because they're being too quiet. And I can hear lots of electric guitars going on, so I know there's some rock stars here, but I know they're very loud and they're easy. You know, I probably will have detected 100% of those. So correct for those, that bias from the detection. We're very fortunate, actually, in gravitational wave detection that we can calculate our selection effects. It's quite easy for us to determine what sources we can detect and what we can't. This is a standing problem in astronomy that we only have one universe, so we need to make sure we understand what we're seeing. And you can know what you detect, but it's very hard to know what you're not detecting. So a lot of astronomy is trying to correct for these. If you have a telescope, that can be very difficult because you've got to calculate, okay, not just what did I see, but what could I have seen? So that would depend on where I was pointing the telescope. It would depend on the weather on a particular day and how cloudy it was. Whereas with our gravitational wave, it's much simpler. What we do is we can inject, is the terminology we use. We simulate signals, put those into our data, run our detection pipelines on that, and see what fraction of the signals that we injected would we recovered, and from that work out, as a function of source parameters, you know, what was the probability that something was detected, and then use that in renormalizing our likelihood to establish, okay, how many of these sources should there have been, given that we saw this many.
It helps a lot that gravitational waves are not blocked by anything in the universe that we know about, except for other black holes. But even then, other black holes tend to be very small and unlikely to get in the way. So when we are able to calculate exactly what the source is doing, it means that we've got a very good idea of what we will see. It doesn't really matter what's in the intervening space. The two banes of astronomy are dust and magnetic fields, and gravitational wave sources don't really care about either of those two things.
Yeah, okay, I see. And that's actually a good thing like that. Indeed, that's quite a luxury to be able to compute your election bias. That's pretty amazing. Me, who've done a lot of political science, you usually cannot do that, so I'm very jealous. And can you tell us, actually, where does that noise come from? Because it seems like you're saying there is a lot of noise in your observations. Thankfully, you're able to tame that somewhat easily. Can you tell us a bit more about that? And John, it seems like you want to add something about that.
Most of the noise, in fact, all of the noise, is not of extraterrestrial origin. It's coming from the detectors and coming from the environment around the detectors. So in order to understand that, you have to know a little bit about how LIGO, Virgo, and Chiral work. So imagine a giant L shape, 4 kilometers long in the case of LIGO, with mirrors at the ends of the arms. And you're shining a laser into the corner, if you like. It gets split into two and sent down both arms, bounces off the mirrors at the end, and then comes back and recombines at the corner. And if the arms are the same length, then the light will constructively interfere, or destructively, I may have that the wrong way around. But the point is, if the arms are different lengths, or if they're changing lengths, then the pattern of the light that comes out will change over time. So we are really worried about anything that can change that output of the laser in the detector. And so that could be due to the laser itself. All the lasers have some amount of noise in them. And so the lasers that are used in these detectors are some of the most stable lasers that you have in the world that have to be invented from scratch, basically, for this problem. It could be the thermal motion of the atoms in the mirrors. That's called thermal noise. And we get around that by simply having a wide enough laser beam that we're averaging over the whole surface of the mirror and cancelling out the mean motion to a low enough level to get the ray. But the laser also, you know, carries energy, and that energy pushes on the mirrors, called radiation pressure noise, which causes the mirrors to move a little bit. And If you think about it the other way around, the laser energy is carried by photons, which are ultimately quantum objects. So they hit off the mirror discreetly, like raindrops on a roof, if you imagine, or if you're in a tent, you get drops of rain. That's kind of what it's like. The lasers are enormously powerful, but still they are made of individual photons. And so there's a sharp noise associated with that, just due to the statistical fluctuation in the number of photons that arrive per second at the output. Then we've got the environment as well, which is especially dominant at low frequencies. So we can't sense anything below about 10 hertz with these detectors that are above the ground because of seismic motion. Now, we do have a lot of techniques to try and screen the mirrors out from the motion of the Earth. They're hung on suspended optics, which act as a natural filter to prevent ground motion from propagating through to the mirror. But even so, we need to have active isolation systems as well. And on top of all of that, even if you manage to screen out all the mechanical coupling, there's unfortunately the gravitational coupling that we can't screen out because we actually want to measure gravity in the first place. So if you imagine a seismic wave, it's a pressure wave in the rock. And when the pressure is high, the rock is actually compressed slightly. And because it's compressed, it's denser than average. And because it's denser than average, it exerts a gravitational pull on the mirrors that tends to pull them along with the seismic waves. So this tiny effect, I mean, you've probably never even thought about it, but it's there as a small gravitational coupling from seismic waves to the detector. And you can't really get around these things at all in the Earth. And so that's why one of the challenges that we're working on at the moment is looking at sending a detector into space, which is hopefully going to open up a whole new range of objects for us to look at.
Let me show you how to be a good Bayesian. Change your predictions after taking information. It